I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to the Midday News Wrap. We begin with State Senator Jim Rosapep with his take on why lawmakers in Annapolis spent this year's session with one eye on Capitol Hill. The Maryland Legislative Black Caucus threatens to sit out next year's General Assembly unless Larry Hogan, Mike Miller, and Mike Bush agree on a special session. President Trump attacks Syria and drops the mother of all bombs in Afghanistan, as North Korea gives indications that it will rattle its nuclear sword sometime this weekend. And how's this for in-flight entertainment? United Airlines now offering drag shows on the tarmac at O'Hare Airport. Economist and author Dr. Julianne Malveau joins me, along with Deborah Bailey of the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper and nonprofit think tanker Diedrich Asante Mohammed. The Midday News Wrap gets underway right after these headlines. And welcome to the Midday News Wrap, everybody. I'm Tom Hall on this Good Friday. We are delighted that you are with us. We're going to start today with State Senator Jim Rosapep. He's a Democrat. He serves as the Deputy Minority Whip. He has represented Maryland's 21st District, which includes Prince George's County and Anne Arundel County, since 2006. Senator Rosapep also served as the ambassador to Romania during the Clinton administration. And full disclosure, he is married to my friend and colleague Sheila Cast, who is the host of On the Record here on WYPR, and he joins us on the line this afternoon. Senator, it's good to talk to you.
Same here.
So let's talk a little bit about this specter of Donald J. Trump hovering over the Maryland General Assembly. Senate President Mike Miller said that we think about it every day, every bill. We think about what's going on Capitol Hill. How does that manifest itself? What did that mean over these last 90 days, which ended on Monday night?
Well, I think the most important thing it meant was that we came together behind a whole variety of initiatives to try to protect Maryland from the dangers that Mr. Trump and his allies in Washington create for our values and our interests here in Maryland. So that includes paying a lot of attention to what they're talking about doing in terms of taking away people's health insurance. We set up a special watchdog commission to follow it in real time, share with our congressional delegation the Maryland impacts, and then prepare for the next legislative session if they do take away people's health insurance, what we need to do to repair the damage. So that's one example. Another example relates to the environment. President Trump proposed eliminating the entire federal Chesapeake Bay cleanup program. And so we said, no. Again, to our congressional delegation, we got to stop that. We got to work with people around the country to protect that. And then specific areas, like he proposed killing Big Bird and taking away money for public television. He proposed taking away money for Meals on Wheels. So in the state budget, we said that if those Trump budget cuts take place in Meals on Wheels, public television, will backfill with state money. So those are some of the examples.
Yesterday, the president signed legislation aimed at getting rid of federal funding for Planned Parenthood. It seems to be, by most assessments, a sort of first step in perhaps a complete defunding of Planned Parenthood. You had some legislation that addressed Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, we did the same thing with Planned Parenthood funding, exactly the same as we did with Meals on Wheels and with Big Bird. If the federal government money goes away from Maryland, we'll backfill it. We can't do that with everything, though. So, for example, on health insurance, there's $1.4 billion of federal money that comes to Maryland under the Affordable Care Act to help low-income people have health insurance. We can't backfill $1.4 billion. So that's more about working with our congressional delegation and folks around the country to stop those changes from happening in Washington.
And this money is in the budget, but do I understand it correctly that it's in the budget, but it gets triggered if something on the federal level happens?
Exactly.
Let's talk about something that had nothing to do with the federal budget, and that is the request by the Legislative Black Caucus to have a special session to take up the issue of medical marijuana and the licenses that were granted to various firms to produce medical marijuana. The clock ran out. There was not time for that bill to see its way through, although people did expect that it was going to pass. Some form of that bill was going to pass. Do you think that the governor, that the Senate president, and that the head of the assembly, Mr. Bush, would be open to the idea of calling everybody back and figuring this out?
I think that's a possibility. That seems to be what the Senate president has said, that he's open to it. My impression is, and I was not that close to that specific piece of legislation, although I supported it, but I think the disagreements between the House and the Senate were resolved right near the end of the session. It just didn't make it across the finish line. So it could be that the governor and the leaders could decide, bring us back for a day and get it done.
Would you support that?
I'd be fine with it. I mean, if they call you to work, you show up.
So, one would hope, right?
Exactly. So if they call a special session, I'll show up.
I mean, most folks think that the governor is disinclined to do that. And a lot of people think that this really has to do more with the sort of internecine battle between the Speaker and the Senate President than it does with Governor Hogan. What's your take on that?
Which is to say that the
House and the Senate couldn't, for a long time, agree on the specifics of the bill.
And I don't want to put words in other people's mouths, and I don't want to say things that I don't know to be true. The reality on medical marijuana is there's big money at stake, and big money fights between people with big money trying to get bigger money. So I think it's a little bit more like the fights we had over many years around casino gambling. It's kind of a gold rush mentality. And so I think most people, you know, want medical marijuana for real medical uses to help real people, to help them. But what's gotten all mixed up in this is a lot of people who think they can make a lot of money over it, and they're fighting over their interest. I think that's what's really going on.
But, of course, if you're a minority-owned firm and you're trying to be part of the gold rush, it seems to me that an awful lot of firms are getting a big head start on the race before you're even able to start running.
Well, I don't disagree with that, but my impression is the fight is not just between minority-owned firms and non-minority-owned firms. It's they're fights among everybody. And that's the reality. And, you know, people who have a deal want to keep a deal. People want to get into the deal want to get into the deal. And so there are disagreements. But very frankly, my understanding is that the leadership of the House and Senate came together at the end of the session. They just couldn't get across the finish line. So if the governor and the leaders decide to pull us back to try to, you know, put that compromise across the finish line, it makes sense to me.
There are about 300,000 federal workers in the state of Maryland. It represents about 10% of our state's workforce. And on Wednesday, the Trump administration asked various agencies to make plans to have big reductions in 2018. That would affect an awful lot of folks in one of the counties that is included in your district,
sure.
Prince George's County.
No, both of them, and Anne Arundel.
And Arundel County. So what do you think that, where does that stand? What do you expect agencies are going to be, obliged to do, and what's that going to mean for your constituents?
Well, I think this is, I mean, obviously it's of concern to a lot of people. It's concern to people who work for the federal government. It's concern to people who rely on federal contracting. It's of concern to people who just understand the economy of Maryland is very much related to the federal government. The other piece of it, though, I think, is it's such another example of how the Trump administration can't seem to get out of its own way. From what I've read about this, they haven't quite figured out how this is going to work. They keep making exceptions. They keep changing their minds. It's a little bit like the travel ban. Is they have the attitude, but they don't seem to have the ability to execute competently. The same thing happened with trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act. They couldn't get their act together on that. So I think one of the dangers to Maryland from the Trump administration, in addition to not sharing our values in a lot of areas, I'm not sure they have their act together.
So is that going to work to the advantage of people?
I don't know.
Who are hoping? Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's total uncertainty, really. I mean, it's just uncertainty because... And, you know, and then all this internecine fighting in the White House, who's in, who's out, people coming, people going. I mean, it's quite amazing, actually.
Governor Hogan was very pleased, generally speaking, with the outcomes of this session that just concluded. The Baltimore Sun in an editorial said it was his most successful legislative session since taking office in 2014. And they also said when it comes to 2018, and he is assuming going to be running for re-election, that it's his race to lose. In terms of the politics of this session, which is the last one before the sort of political climate heats up next year pre-election, what do you think this does for Mr. Hogan's chances in 2018, and where does that leave the Democratic Party in terms of its efforts to regain the statehouse?
Well, I frankly think that it was a successful session. I think mostly related to things we've talked about in terms of protecting Marylanders from the dangers the Trump administration creates. I think we did a lot of things to try to protect the state, banning fracking, giving the Attorney General the ability to sue the drug companies for outrageous increases in prices where they're in competition. So I think we accomplished a lot. I don't think the governor was much of a player in most of those issues. I think on the budget, we passed the budget without much rancor, providing the funds for Baltimore City, which the governor worked with the legislature on, which was great. We protected the education and transportation funding elsewhere in the state. So I think the session was successful. I'm just not sure the governor was that much of a factor.
Let me ask you one question before we let you go. I know you're busy today. As a former diplomat, as a former ambassador to Romania in the Clinton administration, mm-hmm. what's your impression of Rex Tillerson and the State Department and the diplomacy that is taking place? An awful lot of people seem to think that there's the Trump administration is kind of devoid of a coherent strategy when it comes to foreign policy, but we're facing some very big issues: North Korea, Syria. We've just dropped the mother of all bombs in Afghanistan and the fight against ISIS. Where do you see things? Where do you see the United States sitting in the context of the world stage at this juncture?
Well, I think the uncertainty the federal workers have in Anne Arundel County is not that different than the uncertainty that leaders of countries all around the world have. Is because of the way President Trump communicates, shall we say, nobody knows what he's going to do next. And sometimes, you know, strategic uncertainty is an advantage, but often it leads to mistakes. I mean, that is how World War I started. And so I think people around the world and people in the United States are worried about exactly the same thing. Is the lack of clarity, the lack of coherence, the lack of strategy. The one thing I will say, though, is that I disagree with President Trump on many, many, many things, as we've talked about. I do think his more proactive stance in the crisis in Syria, frankly, has been a step in the right direction. Now, does he have a strategy for pursuing that and getting to peace there? I don't know. But I think being more proactive in Syria is very good, not just for the Syrians. It's good for Americans because we understand that the refugee crisis in Europe, as it relates to our relations with the Europeans, refugees here, is related to more than 400,000 people being killed in Syria. And so if we can try to bring peace to Syria with a little more forward-leaning U.S. government effort, I think that's a plus. But otherwise, who knows what's going to happen next?
Getting more involved in Syria and the complications that could arise with Russia and the possibility of escalation there, that doesn't concern you as much as certainly the atrocities that have been taking place and will probably continue?
I think the fact that 4 or 5 years ago the U.S. didn't take a more proactive posture in Syria, invited the Russians in, created the crisis, and made the situation much worse. I mean, I think you can't change the past; you can only change the future. And I think the U.S. being more proactive in trying to bring peace in Syria is a good thing. Now, whether President Trump knows how to do that is a whole other question. But I think when there was that additional gas attack, acting was a what was a constructive thing to do. Where we go from here is sort of the issue.
Senator Jim Rosapep is the Deputy Minority Whip in the Maryland Senate. He represents the 21st District. Senator, thank you for your time. I appreciate it, and have a wonderful holiday weekend.
Good to talk to you.
When we return the Midday News Wrap, we'll take a look at some of the other news of the week with the economist and author Dr. Julianne Malveaux, Diedrich Asante-Mohammed of the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative, and Deborah Bailey of the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper. You are welcome to join us with your thoughts about what's been in the news lately. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. If you want to drop us a tweet, our handle is @MiddayTomHall. Glad you're with us. Stick around. Welcome back. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. The economist Dr. Julianne Malveaux joins us on the line from NPR in Washington. Dr. Malveaux is the founder of the nonprofit Economic Education and a well-known commentator. Julianne, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Tom. Thanks so much for having me.
And with me here in Studio A, Diedrich Asante Mohammed, a senior fellow with the Racial Wealth Divide for Nonprofit Corporation for Economic Development. Diedrich also writes a column about race and inequality for the Huffington Post. Good to see you, Diedrich.
Thanks for having me.
And Deborah Bailey is here as well. She covers Baltimore as a reporter for the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper. Deborah, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Julianne Malveaux, NBC News reporting this morning that the Pentagon is considering preemptive strikes in Korea. The president has sent a fleet of warships to the Korean, to that area, the Korean Peninsula, and he dropped or okayed the use of what they're calling the MOAB, the mother of all bombs, which, interesting, by the way, the program director here at WIPR, Andy Bienstock, refers to our program as that, the mother of all bombs. But that's a separate issue. But,
well, you may want to change your initials.
Yeah, exactly. But all kidding aside, because this is nothing to kid about, is there a relationship between cruise missiles in Syria, this huge piece of ordnance in Afghanistan, and the sending the warships to Korea? What is this signal overall?
Well, it signals what I think many of us were afraid of during the 2016 election, which was the paucity of knowledge that the 45th president has about foreign affairs, his belligerent nature, and his willingness to call for war as opposed to call for negotiation. We have three areas of instability now, and that's really frightening, especially as former vice president, presidential nominee, and of course, Senator Tim Kaine from Virginia talked about, given the number of our young people who are enlisted in the armed services, are going to be put at risk for this. So, you know, Mr. That man, 45, I call him 45, try not to say feed his ego too much, but 45 said he knew more than all the generals, but in fact he has indeed turned over control of much of this to some of the generals, and I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but I think the pugilism, the belligerence, and the way this takes our attention away from his relationships with Russia is really quite frightening. North Korea, they probably don't have anything that could reach the United States, but they certainly can do a lot to destabilize that part of the world and probably even beyond. And so it's a frightening situation.
And Diedrich Asante Mohammed, there's also a question about the effectiveness, the military effectiveness of this. I mean, in Syria, they sent cruise missiles to this airfield, and many reports say that there were planes flying out of that airfield mm-hmm. 24 mm-hmm. hours later. Mm-hmm. Did it work?
Well, I mean, I think, again, the thing that connects all three of those is they're all very Trumpian, right? And where it's a symbolic act that connects well to his constituents. But it's not really clear at all, will they have a strong effect on the conflict in Syria? Will they have a positive effect in dealing with North Korea? Well, and I think that's what everybody's trying to understand, because there seems to be no clear understanding of what the long-term view is in Syria with Assad. Yes, you bombed the Air Force. And I think, too, actually it complicates things, because I think people who want to support the attack in Syria, the 59 missiles that hit Syria, want to take that as, well, that means the Trump administration is now going to fight to overthrow Assad. And I don't think it's that clear. So, again, I think it's very Trumpian. And what concerns me the most is trying to be Trumpian with North Korea. I think that can be a very dangerous situation.
Indeed. And Deborah Bailey, just today, the North Korean, one of Kim Jong-un's ministers in North Korea accused the president of heightened belligerence and said that, you know, North Korea was ready to go to war. That's strong language.
It's very strong language. To the 45th president's credit, he is an executive. He feels he has a competent military presence in place. He has relied on that military presence. I would agree with the bravado. But I think that with the recent actions in Syria, and I think with the continued threats in North Korea, and the fact that that's a wild card situation, I don't think the president of North Korea cares who's in office. He's going to proceed along his track. I think that the president, the symbolic action that he took in Syria, And the symbolic threat, the vice president, I think, is on his way now to South Korea to talk with them about whatever. We don't have a long-term strategy from him in Syria, right? But it may not be a bad thing that some immediate action was taken. It, you know, the threat, you know, to North Korea does involve a lot of bravado. But given that this is their, they're on the verge of their sixth nuclear test, bravado may not be the worst thing in the world. I think we have to have some kind of strong and resolute response.
Deborah, if I could just disagree with you for a moment about the Syria situation. I mean, the Syria situation is a height of hypocrisy. The 45th president says that he took the action because he was moved by seeing pictures of the children. But these are the very children that he's closed our doors to with its travel ban. And so it seems to me, as you said, you're absolutely right that he has no plan. There is no long-term plan around Syria. So this is just a tantrum. This is nothing more than a tantrum because he was moved.
And
being moved is not public policy.
Yeah, and certainly not the first instance of inconsistency with his presidency.
And also, I think with the Trumpian aspect, again, some of these things are getting a whole bunch of press is covering other things. Like, again, the United States bombed Mosul in March, mid-March, and now they're saying 300, and about 90% of them civilians were killed, right? And that is, you know, totally kind of forgotten about while the death of 70 to 80 Syrians in a chemical attack needs to bring the whole world to a stop, and we must do something, so we must send some missiles. The fact that we are increasing bombings all across the world, honestly, and leading to more and more civilians' deaths, there isn't a serious conversation about what does the effect of Trump ratcheting up military presence around the world have on civilians.
And I wouldn't disagree with you that the recent activities have taken the focus off of a number of things, including the investigation about activities of the Trump administration's activities in Russia. I would not disagree with that, but I would say that does not negate the need for there to have been some response.
Some response this time as opposed to any other time? That's my question. I mean, if you would say that you would not allow Syrians to come into the United States, as you know, that this refugee crisis has been escalating. It has been escalating. We've seen these pictures. This isn't the first time there have been pictures of children who have been bombed. This isn't the first time we've seen. There was a picture on the cover of one of the news magazines not 2 months ago of a little boy, torn bloody underwear, laying somewhere. So those things didn't move you, and this one did?
No,
I think we just have to call the hypocrisy. We have to call the hypocrisy and to talk about this really as a tantrum, not an action.
Dr. Julianne Malvo is on the line with us from NPR in Washington. Diedrick Asante Mohammed is a senior fellow with the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative. He's here in Studio A along with Deborah Bailey of the Afro-American Newspaper. If you'd like to join our conversation here on the Midday News Wrap, our number 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayTomHall. We have, by the way, an email from Sharon who says, why do we keep referring to it as the mother of all bombs? I can't imagine a mother dropping this kind of bomb. Let's refer to it as the father of bombs. This mother finds it a bit offensive.
Well, this father doesn't like the idea that a father would drop bombs either, I understand the point she's made.
Exactly. Let's listen to the president in a news conference he gave earlier this week talking about North Korea.
President Xi wants to do the right thing. We had a very good bonding. I think we had a very good chemistry together. I think he wants to help us with North Korea. We talk trade, we talk a lot of things, and I said, the way you're going to make a good trade deal is to help us with North Korea. Otherwise, we're just going to go it alone. That'll be all right, too. But going it alone means going it with lots of other nations.
So, Julianne Malvo, we need to acknowledge that a lot of that is complete nonsense. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. On a couple of levels, when he says going it alone means going it with lots of other nations, I mean, that's not alone. But the other thing I want to ask you about, you're an economist. As I understand it, the United States has free trade agreements with about 20 different countries, and China is not actually one of them. So when he talks about a trade agreement with President Xi Jinping, what is he talking about? Is that a real thing, or is he making that up?
I think he's making it up, although certainly China was not even part of the trade agreement that President Obama wanted us to put together, the international, TIP trade agreement.
The TPP?
Mm-hmm. Yes. China was not part of that. Indeed, the TPP was designed to help us have a base mm-hmm. in that part of the world, in the Asian part of the world, to defend ourselves at some level against China. We're never going to have a solid, friendly trade agreement with China. China, at this point, is our rival. We have to, you know, get ready for that. We can do business, and certainly there may be some limited agreements that are made. But this, again, bluster. The 45th president's stock in trade is bluster. China should help with North Korea. It's right there in their hemisphere. But that doesn't. What kind of trade deal is he offering? Is Congress going to go along with it? Let's not forget that organized labor in particular was very, very opposed to TPP. And I would imagine, given some of the issues of wages and other things that would have to be dealt with in a trade agreement, might be equally opposed to something in China.
But there is there in fact some, you know, actual formal negotiation about a trade agreement with China?
He talks about— Not at this time, not to my knowledge. They might be doing something secretly, but yeah. Nothing that anyone knows about. And again, the president cannot unilaterally force a trade agreement. This is something that would have to go through the Congress. And we saw what happened with TPP. Congress is not inclined to do that.
And Deirdre Kasanti Mohammed, Jeff Sessions, the new attorney general, mm-hmm. Did a bit of his own saber rattling this week. He was at the border between Mexico and Arizona, talking about this is a new era, that's the Trump era, and mm-hmm. Directing prosecutors in the area to really crack down even harder on people crossing the border. He also talked about consent decrees, which, of course, pertains very directly to us here in Baltimore, with a consent decree now in place, signed by the judge last week, requiring big reforms in the Baltimore Police Department. He is not a fan of consent decrees, and he has said as much. What does that mean going forward in terms of what we can expect and how that might, in fact, pertain directly to us here in Maryland?
Well, I think also it's interesting that this week we've kind of seen videos reemerging once again of police brutality, oftentimes white officers against African Americans, whether it was the incident in Georgia where the young man was elbowed in the face and then handcuffed on the ground and then stomped in the face, and the police wrote a completely false report about it, and they actually, surprisingly, were fired initially for that. And then also the young man who was beaten up for jaywalking. That was another video that's coming up. So I think, you know, these types of things, there was slow progress being made under the Obama administration in dealing with some of these issues. But again, I don't think there was any idea that there was going to be clear change in what has been racialized and brutal policing. And I think that's one of the things we have to understand with the Trump administration. It's not oftentimes radical changes. I mean, even this idea we're going to take a stronger stance against immigration. I mean, under President Obama, more immigrants were being pushed out of this country than, you know, at any time in recent history, right? So I think it's more of the bombastic nature in which Trump is doing things versus, is he really doing something different? Even going back to North Korea, there was always a response from the Obama administration with North Korea. It just wasn't a loud, military threatening, bombastic response. It was a more of a, you know, classic State Department international relations response. So I think that's one of the things we need to understand, is just it's more the manner. But I think it really could be dangerous, because we already saw under the Obama administration with Black Attorney General that police kind of had generally pretty free rein to get away with what I consider crimes against minorities. And I think under this administration, it's going to be even clearer that that is okay.
Let's go to the phones. Dave in Baltimore, welcome to the Midday News Wrap. Thanks for your call.
Thanks a lot, Tom. It's a great show, great interviews. And I really appreciate the comments by Ms. Malraux regarding Trump and not wanting to use his name as president and just wanting to use 45. I think this bombing with this mother of all bombs, it's terrorism, and on people of Syria, and here we go, I think 300 and some civilians were killed by one of our bomb droppings in the last week or so, and having a tantrum and having, without consulting Congress, without consulting our allies and going off. This is not a nation's policy. It shouldn't be allowed to be a nation's policy. And I hope we'll see an end to this kind of activity in this coming year.
Right,
thank you very much.
Thank you for your call, Dave. I appreciate it. And Deborah Bailey, you know, again, when we talk about efficacy and you know, whether these things are smart moves militarily, Afghanistan military officials are reporting that perhaps as many as 36 ISIS fighters were killed in this attack, which was, you know, targeted towards a series of caves and underground passageways. Of course, the bomb cost $16 million. So is $16 million worth spending on getting rid of 36 ISIS people who are, you know, running around in caves in the middle of nowhere in Afghanistan?
Of course not. Of course not. But I think that one of the issues that if we want an ideologically linear and consistent president, that's not who Donald Trump is. Donald Trump is a businessman who makes deals based on the activities of the last 8 hours, 16 hours, 24 hours. A significant, not a majority, a significant population of the United States and the right states said that's what they wanted. And people vociferously said, this is what we want. Whatever his strategy is, we're willing to go along with it. So I think at this point, the issue becomes with the world agenda that is on his plate and the national issues that are on his plate, For the majority of Americans who did participate in the vote and the majority of the Americans that didn't vote at all, then I think the issue is, are we going to continue to be reactive or strategic?
Who? The opposition to Trump? Or is Trump going to be reactive or strategic? Because it seems fairly reactive. I mean, like, I would like to get a better understanding. Like, why would we drop, quote unquote, the mother of all bombs to destroy a few tunnels
and maybe
kill 36 people. I don't think anyone really knows how many people were killed.
Because the 45th president of the United States is making an international statement.
Yes.
And the folks who voted for him and said that's a policy that they can stand by.
Well,
so if
it's clear that he's making a political statement to his core constituency, okay, I get that. But then I think the rest of us can talk about, but do we think that is a good choice of use of military force?
And Julianne, before we go to break, he's also reversed himself just this week on four or five major policy assertions he made during the campaign. I mean, during the campaign, he criticized NATO for not focusing on terrorism, even though they do. He said they were obsolete. And now, earlier this week, nope, they're not obsolete. He talked about China repeatedly as being currency manipulators. And just last month, he said, I think they're grand champions at manipulation of currency. And then 2 days ago, he said they're not currency manipulators, right? He talked about the Export-Import Bank. I mean, I wonder how his the people who voted for him, and Deborah's exactly right, folks in particular states voted for him overwhelmingly, how that's reading with everybody.
Well, so the folks in some states voted for him overwhelmingly, but let's not forget that but for 100,000 votes in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, he would not be president. So let's not forget that. It was a very narrow victory. It was not anything overwhelming at all. But that's neither here nor there. He's the elected president of the United States with an asterisk by his name. But he also has been frightfully inconsistent. You can take his comments during the campaign and put them against actions now, NATO being among the least of those, being so many other conversations. Some of the people in his core constituency have stood by him. But some of those who see their health care running away from them, who do not want us to be back in some kind of international war, those people are looking askance at him right now. And the only thing that he has accomplished, let's not forget that he's tick-tocking towards his 100 days. What had he accomplished before he started this bombing? He had simply gotten Gorsuch through. That would be the only thing that he had accomplished. Now he can say he also bombed Afghanistan to the tune of $16 million, which he could have used to pay for Meals on Wheels.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. We got to take a little break. We will be back in a flash. Dr. Julianne Malveaux is an economist and the former president of Bennett College in Greensboro, North Carolina. She also hosts a new podcast called It's Personal with Dr. J. By the way, Julianne, did you clear that with Julius Erving?
He and I have been through that. I told him he was the original, and he said that he was. So I said I was. He said he was. So I think he's a little older than me. He could have first dibs.
Okay, he has first dibs on that. Deborah Bailey's here as well. She's a reporter for the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper, along with Diedrick Asante Mohammed, who's here in Studio A. He's a senior fellow with the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative at the Nonprofit Corporation for Economic Development. Our phone number on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @Midday. Tom Hall. Stick around. We will be back. Back. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. Diedrick Asante Mohammed is a senior fellow with the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative at the Nonprofit Corporation for Economic Development. Dr. Julianne Malveaux is the founder and owner of the nonprofit Economic Education. She's also the former president of Bennett College, the country's oldest historically black college for women, and the author of several books, including Are We Better Off? Race, Obama, and Public Policy. She's on the line with us from NPR in Washington. Deborah Bailey is a reporter for the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper. She's here in the studio as well. Our number on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Let's go to the phones. Timothy in Aberdeen, welcome to the News Wrap. Thanks for your call.
Hi, how you doing? I'm a big fan of the show. I'm calling in to, because I don't actually think that the use of the Moab was an excessive use of force. I mean, it's only 10 to 20 times larger than one of our bombs that get dropped every other day. And it was, the decision to use it was made by General Mattis, who has a reputation of being very pragmatic. And it was it took a week to get the bomb out there. So if they could have got it done sooner with something smaller, I think they would have.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. I mean, Julianne Malveaux, when it comes to the advisors that Mr. Trump has around him, we see the sort of flagrant incompetence of his press secretary, Mr. Spicer, this week. And we've got, Mr. Bannon, we've got his son-in-law, Mr. Kushner, who seems to have a portfolio of the size of the state of Rhode Island. But a lot of folks do say that his military advisors, his defense and national security advisors, are a good bunch. What do you think?
Well, they seem to be, they seem to come out of conventional military wisdom, which means that they tend to be a bit more hawkish than dovish. They all know each other. They've gone to West Point, wherever, moved up the ladder. Many of them do not identify as either, have partisan identification. They see their work as maintaining the security of the United States. I think that they're okay. I wouldn't give them the hawkish part. Always gives me pause. When the previous call I called and said, well, he thought this bomb was only 20 times more than the kind we, mm-hmm. use the word only in connection to a bomb. And I immediately have a pause. I think that we do not need, there may have been times when we needed to be more confrontive, but I don't think that this is a time to be more confrontive. And I would not necessarily say that generals, although very talented, may always be right.
And let me just put forward the idea that Mattis is known for being tempered in some way. I mean, his nickname's Mad Dog Mattis, right? He's the one who approved the bombing of a wedding party and said there's no way people would have a wedding in the middle of a desert. The 42 people were killed. So, and again, I'm not saying he's like a horrible general whatsoever, but the idea, he's not known for being tempered or conservative in response. And I think that's a concern we have to have. I think there is a very strong, I think the military is very excited that they are going to be unleashed now. And is that good for American interests? It might be good for Trump's core constituency, who loves to see bombs going off every once in a while as long as troops aren't on the ground. But is that going to help deal with the situations on the ground? And I think that's very unclear.
Let's go to the phones again. Rabia in Baltimore, welcome to Midday in the News Wrap. Appreciate your call.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Tom, for your program. I really appreciate all the discussions that you have had on this program. I have a quick question for your panel, and just to open the eyes of people who are listening. I'm originally from Syria, and the topic of bombing Syria is very close to my heart, definitely. But the question is, I don't understand how the policy of this country would be. Someone on your panel mentioned hypocrisy, and I see it hypocritic in the sense that some countries that are extremist in their records of human rights, and like Saudi Arabia or Turkey now, earlier today they were talking about how Erdogan is becoming more extremist in his policies, and we're
he's the president of Turkey, right?
Them. So why is that discrepancy? Why is money and oil controlling policy rather than human rights? If only United States can stand for human rights sincerely, then the world would be a better place for everyone.
And Deborah Bailey, I mean, you mentioned that the current president is a business person, and Julianne Malveaux mentioned that his understanding, his embrace and just, you know, grasp of the incredibly complicated interrelations in that area of the world is by most accounts pretty lacking.
I would agree that President Trump, or the 45th president of the United States, his depth is not in international policy. I also agree that he
has... Nor domestic policy, but go ahead.
or just policy.
let's come back. We'll come back to the domestic side.
But people said the same thing about Barack Obama. They said the same thing about the former governor of Texas, George W. Bush. I mean, that's not a new thing.
Except they both were elected officials who had some experience in policy. Trump had none.
Okay, let's come back to that. But I would, to the caller's question, I think that we're going to see a number of shifts in his attitude toward what have been conventional friends and conventional enemies. You know, and I say all of this not because I'm just a great fan, but because I'm a pragmatist. This man is the president of the United States. And my issue is, okay, how do we effectively deal with what we have and who we're working with?
I want to play.
Yeah, but I think that we're all pragmatists here. I think we have to play the hand we're dealt, but we don't have to be happy about it. Number one, and number two, we do not have to co-sign some of this nonsense. Part of resisting is pointing out where this person is absolutely wrong. Wrong-headed, wrong in his appointments, and we can go down the list. We've got Sessions, who basically is declaring war on a people in places like Baltimore, where there was a consent decree. He wants to overturn the consent decree. So far, the courts say no, but he's still going to be persistent about it. He wants to have all those consent decrees examined. Should we be quiet? No. Does that make us non-pragmatic? No, because a few people can make a difference when we speak up. No, we're not going to penetrate that orange helmet that the 45th president wears on his head. But we may well be able to move others to do things. And as people go to their congressional offices, as people push to ensure that their congresspeople, be they Democratic or Republican, respond to their concerns, the tide may shift. That's not non-pragmatic. That is being in the mode of resistance that people of conscience who care about economic justice must be in.
And for all the detractors that President Trump has, he certainly also has many supporters, some of whom actually are in the media. Here's a little montage of some of those folks.
He demonstrated that he was going to act, and he did act, as commander-in-chief last night.
He took swift, decisive action, and it made Americans proud. I think it made people all around the world proud.
How cool is that, to actually make the Chinese Politburo sit through a night of American-targeted bombing?
We see these beautiful pictures at night from the decks of these two U.S. Navy vessels in the Eastern Mediterranean. I am tempted to quote the great Leonard Cohen, "I'm guided by the beauty of our weapons."
Brian Williams, quite taken with Mr. Trump's decision to bomb the airbase in Syria. And I want to talk about this in terms, believe it or not, of the United Airlines story this week. And here's what I want to say about that, if you could indulge me for a second. Everybody's talking about the PR debacle that we have with the people at United Airlines and how badly they handled this situation. It seems to me the question that nobody's asking and they should be asking is, why was violence the only solution that anybody could come up with to that particular situation? We've got gate agents. We've got a flight crew. We've got a pilot who is completely in control of who flies on his or her airplane or who does not fly. And I've certainly seen people kicked off airplanes before by the pilot, who has full authority to do that. I haven't heard anything from the pilot. And of course, we have these private contracting law enforcement people who did the deed. I mean, Julia Malvo, this seems to me to be directly related to police brutality against communities of color, in that there is a paucity of imagination when it comes to these situations. And nobody, none of those people could think of anything else to do other than drag this doctor off of the plane.
This was so absurd for so many reasons. And you're right. There were so many levels at which someone could have stepped in. And indeed, what the airline could have easily done, the top offer they gave was $800. By law, they could offer up to $1,350 cash, but they can also throw other stuff in. So they could have offered the maximum $1,350, and then they could have thrown in two round-trip tickets to wherever. Believe me, half of those people would come stampeding off that plane if they had made the right offer. They didn't. I hate to say this, guys, don't beat me up, but I understand it was a male flight attendant. Maybe it's just a little bit too much testosterone running around. But there does seem to be, the inclination to go nuclear, if you pardon the word, as opposed to, basically moving slowly with these situations.
Yeah, and that then pertains to people's apparent support in many quarters of the president for dropping the mother of all bombs in Afghanistan and bombing Syria and sending the warships to Korea. I mean, it's interrelated, isn't
it? Well, what I do think is people get wrong about Trump is that Trump is not an aberration of Americanness. He's a great symbol of Americanness, of being kind of arrogant, of being brash, of being strong regardless of the consequences. And I think, and he plays to that, and that's why he plays well to a large part of the American public. It's for this airline piece, I mean, it's clear the airline was wrong over and over and over again. Why were people even on the plane if the plane was oversold? When I've always seen the plane was oversold, they did these offers before you got on the
plane.
Well
before you got seated.
They sat him down, they gave him the seat, and then the security officers who were fired and being blamed, they clearly were ordered to remove this person. Like, and then even the president of United was first being supportive of it. So it became violent because there was an unjust situation. And the only way to deal with an unjust situation that was orchestrated to that level was just to physically remove this person. And now, I mean, it's clearly United Airlines has refunded every person on that plane's ticket. And now they're going to be sued. And the guy lost several teeth and had a severe concussion. You know, it was horrific. But again, that's my concern, is that Trump might lead us by doing things over and over again and trying to be so bombastic that we get in even a worse situation.
Right, well, I'm afraid we are out of time. We have to end on that very cheerful note, and apologize for not being able to get to a couple of calls. And Deborah, I know you had a comment you wanted to make, but we just don't have time. Next time, I promise. So thank you all. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You.
Thank you.
Dr. Julianne Malvo is the founder of the nonprofit Economic Education and the author of several books, including Are We Better Off? Race, Obama, and Public Policy. She's also the host of a new podcast called It's Personal with Dr. J, which you can download on iTunes. Deborah Bailey is a reporter for the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper, and Deidre Cassante Mohammed is a senior fellow with the Racial Wealth Divide Initiative. He authored a report a few months back about the racial wealth divide here in Baltimore. We'll have links to that report, to Dr. Malvo's podcast, and to the Afro on the web, wipr.org/midday. Coming up on Midday Monday, a status report on where things stand with the ACA. Julie Rovner, the senior Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News, Brad Herring of Johns Hopkins University, and Andrew Ratner of the Maryland Health Benefits Exchange. They're going to join me for that discussion. I hope you can join us as well. Thanks to Marie-Louise Bistro for providing lunch today. They're located on Charles Street in Mount Vernon here in Baltimore. They specialize in a blend of French, Italian, and Mediterranean cuisines. They're open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, or dinner, with brunch on Saturday and Sunday. Menu and reservations at marieLouiseBistroCatering.com. Our show is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Charlie Hines provided production assistant. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. And yes, he is as dreamy as you think he may be. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Reveal is up next after a break for the news. Have a happy Easter and a great weekend.